Well, welcome, Representative Holt.
How you doing, Oliver?
Good to see you again. Yeah, this is part four of our ongoing conversation about what's going on at the Capitol.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been great doing this.
I've heard you guys have had a crazy busy week and some late nights.
We have, because this week we began to do the pieces of legislation that the other side hates, that the Democrats hate. And so we did two, what I think are very, very important pieces of legislation this week, the Iowa History Initiative, and then we passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, something we've been working on in the 10 years that I've been serving. We've never been able to do it, and we got it done. The Senate already passed it. So those were two monumental pieces of legislation we got done this week. Neither of those do the Democrats like it at all. It's hard to understand why, but they didn't. So we were there two very late nights.
Yeah, I heard till like 11 p.m. on Thursday night.
Yeah, we did the History Initiative. We did a couple of days ago. We did the Religious Freedom Restoration Act yesterday. We were there yesterday, which was Thursday. We were there until something like 8 or 9 o'clock, somewhere around 8 p.m. in the evening. Several days before that, when we did the Iowa History Initiative, I guess that was Wednesday. I lose track of days, but we were there till 11 p.m. that night.
What is the Iowa History Initiative?
Well, you know, there's a strong feeling amongst Republicans, and I think many, many Americans recognize this, because if you look at the polling, a massive number of Iowans support redoing our history and civic curriculum. It's very obvious from what we see going on in our streets today. It's very obvious when you talk to young people today and in polling, they do not appreciate being an American as those who came before them did. They clearly do not understand the principles of our republic. They clearly do not know our history. Now, they can spout off to you all the wrongs in our history, and they can spout off to you, you know, that America is an inherently racist nation, or that meritocracy is a part of white supremacy. These DEI, critical race theory concepts, that seem to be the things being concentrated on, but they can't tell you what happened on December 7th, 1941. I'm blown away that they don't oftentimes know who we fought in World War II. They don't know who the Allied powers were, who the Axis powers were. They know very, very little about American history. So it seems that I think there's a lot of factors at play here. I think a lot of young people today are learning what they know on TikTok, which, of course, is a Chinese communist platform. They're learning what they know on social media, on X, Snapchat, you name it, the programs they watch, social media, Facebook, whatever ones that they're using. And so, and in addition to that, unfortunately, I think as a result of all of our emphasis on STEM over the years, and STEM is very important, but as technology has rapidly advanced and we've begun to focus on STEM, I think we have totally dropped the ball on American history, on civics. And that is why, you know, if you look across our country, less and less people are volunteering. Less and less people understand or seem to care about what it means to be a citizen. Less and less of our young people seem to understand what it means to be an American. And so all of those things together, along with, you know, you look today, and there are a number of factors involved here too, but military having extremely difficult time meeting their recruiting goals. I think part of that is because we have a disastrous administration. We have a disaster that happened in Afghanistan. We have the woke garbage going on in our military. And so people that traditionally would have served, that came from families who have a tradition of serving, and that's normally where people in the military come from, families who have that tradition of serving. I think a lot of people, a lot of young people are being told by their parents or grandparents who served, don't serve right now because of what they see happening, the disaster they see happening with our military and with our country and with this administration. But in addition to that, it is because kids are getting taught that meritocracy is a part of white supremacy, that the country is inherently racist. I think the emphasis is on all the bad parts of our history. And certainly there are, you know, we've made mistakes in our history, no question about that. But they're not taught, they're not teaching American exceptionalism anymore. They're not teaching de Tocqueville. They're not teaching the sacrifices of the greatest generation. They're not teaching American exceptionalism. And so this, the American History Initiative says, no, we're going to go back to basics in American history. You will teach about George Washington. You will teach the Emancipation Proclamation. You will teach about the Bill of Rights and and, you know, all of these important figures in our history, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, you will teach about Western civilization. So this is what the Democrats object to. So they think it's too prescriptive, because we don't normally, we're not normally that prescriptive when it comes to, you know, what we tell schools to do. The problem is the Common Core standards are pathetic. They're vague. They're not. And it is clear that the things that need to be taught about our history are not being taught. And what is being emphasized is all of the stuff related to the mistakes we've made in our history. So that is why we said, yeah, we aren't normally just prescriptive, but we're done. We're done watching our country being destroyed, because the original point of public education was to foster good citizenship. We've dropped the ball on that. We seem to have totally forgotten that fact. And so we're saying, no, we're going back to basics in history. We're going to teach good citizenship. We're going to teach what is noble in the American character. We're going to teach American exceptionalism in addition to the negative aspects of our history. And one of the things the Democrats kept talking about, you're just focusing on the positive. You're not going to teach the bad things we've done. Not true. You can't teach about the Emancipation Proclamation without teaching about slavery. You can't teach the Civil War without teaching the fact that there was slavery. I brought out in my comments on the floor, how about we teach about Iwo Jima? How about we teach about a flag raiser by the name of Ira Hayes, who was a Native American who served and was rejected by his people after that, because they thought he went off and fought the white man's war. He ended up being an alcoholic and died due to alcohol poisoning and freezing temperatures. He was buried not too far in Arlington Cemetery, not too far from the Marine Corps War Memorial that depicts, you know, him as one of the flag raisers on Iwo Jima. In teaching his story alone, you would teach the good, the bad, and the ugly in our history. And so my point was, you know, you teach real American history, you teach the good and the, you know, you're going to get it all. If you teach real American history, you're going to teach the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think we're emphasizing the ugly today. And that's why Republicans stood up and said enough. We're not going to do that anymore, because we're going to lose our country if we continue to do that. You can see it in our streets today. If people don't appreciate this republic and understand the principles of this republic, our founding fathers warned us. What did Ben Franklin say when he walked out of the room? What kind of government do you have? A republic if you can keep it. We're going to keep it. And so that is why we passed it. And I got to tell you, some of the comments on the floor from Democrats show exactly why we need to pass this. A few days ago, we're commemorating Black History Month in the Iowa House, and every morning someone will get up and give a couple of minute, are supposed to be giving a couple minute presentation on the on a great African American in our history. You could talk about George Washington Carver, any number of people, right? The Tuskegee Airmen, any, you know, wonderful people. Well, Representative Crokin, a Democrat, gets up on the floor a few days ago, doesn't talk about any individual. He just talks about how horrible the country is, how horribly racist we are. He ranted on for 3 or 4 minutes, totally ignoring what Black History Month is supposed to be about. And this, there's almost a hatred and a vitriol, well, there is, from the left and from some, you know, I won't say all Democrats, because that's not true. But there are some Democrats that share this, and it showed when we debated this bill. Now, some of them
did any Democrats vote for the bill?
I don't believe so, but I'm not certain of that. But I don't believe there were.
How were the votes from the Republicans? Was it a consensus, or were there some that did not vote for it?
Yeah, I believe there were 3 Republicans that voted against it, and their main concern, having been educators, was they thought it was too prescriptive, not that we shouldn't be teaching these things. So their reason for voting against it was different. And I think, in fairness, some of the Democrats voted against it for that reason, too. They don't think it that we should be prescriptive, that we should leave it to the experts. But the experts aren't getting it right. It's that simple. The experts are not getting it right.
CRT and SEL and everything that's seeped into our school systems now that's teaching our kids these divisive concepts. And
exactly.
Now we even have AI that's woke, that I don't know if you heard about Google's AI Gemini 1.5. They would ask it to give a picture of the founding fathers, and it would come up with Black people, or the Pope, and it would come up with a a black person and an Indian, or the founders of Google and they were Asian. So it was pulling up historical figures and diversifying them because of the programming.
Here we come, 1984. Right. We're gonna country's gonna be destroyed if we don't get a handle on it. We're well on our way, and so this is an attempt to do that. There's certainly some problems with the legislation. It's gone over to the Senate now. There'll be some things we need to fix. It's not by any means perfect at this point, but we sent it over to the Senate to continue those discussions. We think it's an important piece of legislation. Definitely there can be some and will be some changes made if it actually gets to the governor's desk. Don't know if it will or not, because again, a lot of folks, Republican or Democrat, don't like the prescriptive nature of what we did, but we just, you know, a lot of the fundamental principles in it comes from a group called the Civics Alliance, which is a conservative organization that believes we should teach real history. And again, I would say folks always on the other side want to say, you just want to whitewash. I keep hearing that, whitewash history. That's not true at all. We want to teach all history, the good, the bad, and the ugly in American history, but not just. And that's what folks seem to want to do today. They don't. And I think these folks don't believe that America is exceptional. They don't believe in de Tocqueville. That's why they don't teach him. And they, you know, they bought into the 1619 Project garbage. And so that is why these things aren't being taught in many of our institutions today. And we're going to try to change that.
What's the gist of the 1619 Project garbage?
Oh my gosh, the 1619 Project.
I said this was going to be short, but
you know, basically the Constitution was written to preserve slavery, the institution of slavery, that the real history, horrible history of our country, you know, started back in 1619. It's just complete revisionist history, and even a lot of liberal folks in the history scholars have said, you know, this is ridiculous. This is not true. But a lot of people have adopted that and are continuing to push the 1619 Project. There's another book that's come out in response to the 1619 Project. I'm trying to remember the name of it because I'm going to get it and read it. I think it's called 1620. But anyway, it is in response to, 1620, a critical response to the 1619 Project that actually rebukes all of the garbage in the 1619 Project. But yeah, this is the way we're heading. Just the hatred of America that is entering into our classrooms is unbelievable. And it's so much more important today that we teach this history than we did even when I was growing up, because when I was growing up, I could actually talk to World War II veterans and they could tell me what they saw when they walked into these Jewish concentration camps, Auschwitz, and I had an uncle that served on Iwo Jima. And even though he never would talk about it, he never talked about his war service, but I could look into his eyes and know the hell that he went through and knew that I had to be willing to do the same to preserve the country. Our kids don't know that anymore. They just don't. And we have to teach it.
They don't. I think Man's Search for Meaning should be required reading in high school. I mean, great book by Viktor Frankl about Auschwitz and the good thing about that book is about finding meaning in suffering as well.
Well, I should have mentioned that one of the things in this legislation in our history initiative is that the Holocaust has to be taught about, because a lot of kids don't know what it is. They don't believe it happened in some cases because of all the garbage they're being fed on social media and from liberal idiotic professors. And so we mandate in that bill, you will teach about the Holocaust because it's alarming the number of kids that don't know about that or don't believe it, and the amount of anti-Semitism that we're seeing in our country. So that's a part of the bill, is that you will teach the Holocaust. And we've even named some of the sites that they need or the sources they need to use, such as the Holocaust Museum has excellent information in Washington, D.C. So, you know, we're doing all we can to respond to what we're seeing in our country. And this is an important piece of legislation. I hope changes get made to it. It gets better and it gets to the governor's desk.
That would be amazing. Was there any re-enlivening of the alternate teacher licensure legislation from last year that didn't make it through?
You know, that's still, I think we sent that to the Senate. I think that's what you're talking about, right? We sent it to the Senate. Yeah, there's still the possibility those things can be passed, and we'll see if the Senate does it this year. We're going to have a list of priorities. We're going to try to work with them you know, just the simple fact of the matter is we've sent them a large number of pieces of legislation. They've sent not so many over to us, But we're, you know, there's a lot of these things that are very, very important to us, and we're going to do our best to get them passed and to get the Senate to pass them and get them to the governor's desk. But I can't say for certain whether they will or not.
Right, right. So that was about a 3-hour debate on Wednesday, right? And then then you went to Common Core, and that was about a 10-minute deal. Yeah. I heard that passed quickly.
You know, it's absolutely incredible. And again, sometimes I think we're victims of our success. Conservatives in this state and folks that are concerned about what they see happening in the country need to really appreciate living in Iowa. We don't get everything right, but a few years ago, we couldn't have even had a discussion about touching Common Core. And we passed a bill to create a study to begin to dismantle and get rid of Common Core because it isn't working.
Right.
We couldn't have even thought about that a few years ago. We couldn't have possibly passed almost every education bill we've passed this year to push back on the stuff that's happening and to try to improve education for our children, such as this history initiative we've been talking about. Couldn't have done it a few years ago. And as the Iowa House and Senate have become more conservative, as people are seeing what's happening to our country and more Republicans are being elected across the state, with a majority of 64 in the House and a lot of conservatives elected in the last election, we've been able to do things we couldn't have even hardly thought about before, such as the history initiative, such as beginning to look at getting rid of Common Core, and such as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, also known as RFRA, that we passed.
Right, right. That's amazing. And RFRA, how did that go? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, as chair of judiciary, I've been trying to get Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed for several years. Haven't been able to do it for various reasons. Mostly we just didn't have the support for it. Folks would listen to the other side and they would tell all the horror stories that would happen if we passed RFRA. And so it wasn't able to get done. This year, it looked very different. Senator Whitfer, I believe, had attended an ADF conference, Alliance Defending Freedom, just a fantastic, wonderful organization that goes all over the country fighting for freedom and fighting against religious prosecutions and things of that kind that are violating the First Amendment. And the Senate position changed very much, that they were very interested in doing RFRA, and we began to realize in the House that we had the votes to do RFRA. You know, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I would bring people back to when it passed in Indiana, and there was such a massive disaster there that Mike Pence had to go back and they had to water it down, and it passed other places and people just freaked out and all of the businesses are going to leave and all the sports teams are going to leave. And this has been the battle cry. It's utterly nonsensical because the Religious Freedom Restoration Act doesn't do any of the things that the opposition claims it will do.
Can you give us a synopsis on what it does actually do?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what happened was there's for our, most sacred fundamental rights, such as the Second Amendment, free speech and association, religious liberty, and the First Amendment. For many, many years, the test that has been used is called a compelling interest test, compelling government interest with a narrowly tailored solution. So anytime the government infringes on Second Amendment rights, free speech and association rights, the highest judicial standard possible is that if the government's going to do that, it has to be a compelling government interest. It has to be a compelling government interest for them to infringe on the Second Amendment, infringe upon free speech and association, or infringe upon religious liberty. So it has to be a compelling government interest. And if that compelling government interest is there, then the solution has to be narrowly tailored so that it infringes on those fundamental freedoms as little as possible. That had been the standard in our country until 1990. And there was a case for the Native American tribe in which the Supreme Court turned in a ruling, turned the compelling interest test on its head. And in that court ruling, they basically said, well, unless the law specifically tailors, specifically targets religion, it doesn't matter. It's okay unless it specifically targets religion. So that left thousands of laws untouched so that thousands of laws could infringe upon religious liberty and there wasn't a thing that could be done about it. Therefore, in 1993, and it's amazing how this has gotten to the point now where Democrats are bitterly opposed to it. Guess who introduced Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993? It was Senator Chuck Schumer. Because it wasn't about Christians. It was in response to a Native American situation in that horrific court ruling. the president of the American Civil Liberties Union at the time called that ruling that I'm talking about the Dred Scott of the First Amendment. So Senator Chuck Schumer introduces the Religious Freedom Restoration Act on the federal level. Bill Clinton signs it into law in 1993 with every member of the U.S. House, Democrat and Republican, voting for it. And all but three senators, voted for it in the Senate. So 97 senators, all members of the House, voted for it. President Bill Clinton signs it into law. Fast forward. So then we've reestablished what had always been the case, the compelling government interest test with a narrowly tailored solution was restored for religious liberty when the government would infringe on religious liberty, just as we have for free speech and association, just as we have for the Second Amendment. Fast forward a few years and another court ruling says, well, Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies only to federal laws or federal infringement on religious liberty. It doesn't apply to the state. So at that point, states begin to pass their own RFRA laws. And at this point in time, 21 states, well, until yesterday, 21 states had passed religious liberty RFRA laws. Another four states had RFRA effectively in place because of court rulings. So we had something around 25 states that had RFRA in place. Iowa was not one of them. We've been trying for, like I said, a number of years to get the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed. And we had the votes to do it this year. The Senate had already passed it, sent it over to us, and we passed it yesterday. And I have to talk a bit about the insanity that took place on the floor yesterday. It was absolutely unbelievable. But what I would also say, the amazing thing is that yesterday, about 2 hours before our vote to pass RFRA, Georgia passed it with every Republican voting for it.
Wow.
And just a week or two ago, Utah passed it. So we're now approaching 30 states that will have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in place.
So now the battle, can you give us an example of how that would affect an Iowa citizen, like how their religious freedom might be infringed upon and how that would bolster it?
Yeah. So, and all it is it creates a balancing test for the courts. It doesn't guarantee winners and losers. It just creates a balancing test. And it asks that question to the courts. Is this a compelling government interest? Because you're in, and it only applies to government action, has nothing to do with businesses. That's another thing was misrepresented by Democrats on the floor yesterday. Surprise, surprise. It only applies to government action that infringes. So, and then it tells the courts, okay, if you're infringing on religious liberty, government, is it a compelling government interest? And is there a narrowly tailored solution? So here's an example of how it was used. One of my favorite examples is how RFRA was used in another state, is that the Amish community don't like modern technology. And one of the requirements the state wanted to put on the back of their buggies was this triangle with the orange reflective tape on it so that they would be safe at night in their buggies on the road. That was indeed a compelling government interest, but it was a violation of their religious freedom. So how did RFRA take care of this? I think this is a wonderful story. So what RFRA did and the court decision was, well, there's a compelling government interest in safety, but what's the narrowly tailored solution? So the narrowly tailored solution was allowing the Amish to hang a lantern on the back of their buggies that didn't violate their religious liberty. That's an example of how RFRA has been used. Another example, there was a Native American young man. Part of his religious faith was to have his hair long. And for some reason, this ridiculous school said, you can't have your hair long. You either have to cut it or hide it, right? Well, the court said, no, sorry, but that is their religious belief. And there's no compelling government interest to tell him to cut his hair. So these are examples of how RFRA has been used. It has never been used as a way to allow discrimination. Why is that? Because it's a compelling government interest to prevent racial discrimination or discrimination. So, you know, if you've got a religious belief here that would allow for some sort of, you know, discrimination, RFRA is not, no, it's a balancing test. So it's never been used successfully for discrimination. It's never been used in that way. And so there, the parade of horribles that they always parade out are lies. They've never happened. And by the way, one of the things that they might call the LGBT community might call discrimination, I wouldn't call discrimination. An example of that might be, if it's someone's firmly held religious beliefs as a florist not to provide flowers to a gay wedding, then RFRA in place is not going to guarantee a winner or loser, because in fact under RFRA there was a wedding cake maker who lost under RFRA, and so it isn't going to guarantee in any way that the person's firmly held religious beliefs in court are going to win, but it would at least create the balancing test so that the court has to say, okay, what's the compelling government interest and is it narrowly tailored? And you might argue, well, there's plenty of other florists or there's plenty of other bakers. We don't have to violate this person's firmly held religious beliefs, but doesn't necessarily mean that, because as I said, there was a baker that used the RFRA defense and did not win. So again, it doesn't guarantee winners and losers, but there's this, the amount of insanity on the floor and the lies. Actually, the bottom line is there are members of the LGBT community that want a rigged system. They don't even want the chance that a person of faith whose religious convictions are violated, they don't want them to have a fair day in court. They want the system to be rigged. And so that's why there's such opposition to it and why we spent hours in debate. And I would encourage folks, I'm going to put on my Facebook page in the next few days, I'm going to put my response to them. It was very hard to keep my emotions in check because I listened to 3 hours of things that weren't true. And I just want to share a few of them with you, if you'd allow me the opportunity, because it blew me away.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
In my 10 years serving in the Iowa House, I've never heard the kind of distortions that I heard over the RFRA legislation that we were debating. So they talked about cases in South Carolina and Michigan and talking about these egregious rulings under RFRA. But in fact, the cases they were talking about in South Carolina and Michigan were not even RFRA cases. RFRA had nothing to do with them. They talked about some cases in Michigan and Mississippi, and Michigan and Mississippi don't even have RFRA statutes in place. They talked about all these medical situations where doctors had refused certain procedures or something to people. And they were saying that it was because of RFRA, when in fact, none of those cases were RFRA cases. There were cases where in those particular states, they have laws on the books for medical conscience or right of conscience for doctors. And so those cases were decided under those laws and not RFRA at all. They talked about a Bush versus Nebraska case, where, you know, this ruling was terrible ruling was because of RFRA, when in fact the ruling was that no, RFRA did not apply, but the court went on to rule in favor because they said you can't compel somebody to communicate a message that violated their beliefs. So the ruling went against what the Democrats liked, but it wasn't because of RFRA. It was the court saying you can't make somebody say something that's a violation of their beliefs. Then they talked about an Elaine photography case that was a RFRA case, but in fact, in that case, and that's what I was meant to say earlier, I said Baker, but it was actually a photographer. I apologize for that. In that Elaine photography case they talked about that used a RFRA argument, the wedding photographer actually lost that case. Go figure. Then they talked about a Trinity Christian case, which was not a RFRA case at all. Instead, it was a ministerial exception case. They talked about housing discrimination, how RFRA has never been used to allow or deny housing, never has been done. And here's a good one. They talked about not allowing access to contraception, and they went all over this one case, and it was unbelievable. In that case, what they failed to talk about was it was the Sisters of the Poor, where nuns were actually being fined for not paying for abortifacients. And the court said the government can advance any interest it had by providing those drugs, but they can't force religious organizations to pay for it, because that's not the least restrictive means of advancing what the government interest was at that time. So they were talking about forcing nuns and fining nuns because they wanted them to provide abortion drugs that were against their religion. So insane. They forgot that part on the floor. They talked about a case that was Smith versus Fair Housing, which was the California case, but it wasn't. There was no state RFRA involved, and the federal RFRA claim was decided in favor of the government because they found there was no substantial burden on religion. They left that part out. Amazing. And they talked about how it was going to destroy. Everybody was going to leave Iowa, and it was going to destroy economic development. And every state in the Forbes top 10 states have a RFRA statute in place or court rulings have resulted in the RFRA standard.
They're constantly saying everybody's going to leave Iowa.
Yeah. It was amazing.
And it's growing.
I could go on and on, but as far as I can tell, every case that they referenced was not a RFRA case. And so it was really difficult for me to sit there and listen to it. In fact, I paced back and forth in the back of the chamber to keep my energy from exploding because I couldn't wait to respond to all of it. And I did respond to it, but it was just amazing because none of the cases were RFRA cases that I could.
How did you know that? I mean, without having to, it seems to me like they make the case and then you'd have to research that.
Well, I have a really good staff that really fast is researching things. And I have some very good folks from First Amendment organizations, from the Alliance Defending Freedom that, you know, actually came to this state to help us. And we're standing by and we're actually sending me text messages because obviously
this is real time. This is real time. You're on the floor listening to this stuff and you've got your team that's doing the research. And then they're updating you. And so then you were able to rebuttal it right then. That's awesome.
Exactly. And, but it was so frustrating to me because, like I said, in all the 10 years I've served in the House, you know, I listen to sometimes debate and I categorically disagree with them on things. As Ronald Reagan famously said, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, Democrats believe in. The problem is that, you know, a lot of them aren't true. You know, they know so much, but a lot of things they know aren't true. So there's been a lot of debates where, you know, I've understood that, you know, they believe these things. I just don't happen to believe that they're accurate. But in this case, holy cow. I mean, it was just an incredible misrepresentation when you're talking about all these cases and then the cases aren't even RFRA cases. The other thing that blew my mind is they talked about how divisive this law is. And one of the things that I stood up on the floor and said in my closing remarks is what is divisive? Is when you totally misrepresent what this legislation does and scare the heck out of people. And then you wonder why people leave the state because you're telling them, you know, their rights are going to be violated when in fact RFRA has never been used in that way. So what they want is a rigged system. And you could tell the animosity toward people of faith that came from some Democrats was unbelievable. And it just demonstrated why we need the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because there's an incredible level of animosity toward people of faith coming from the left today. It's a sad place.
Isn't that pretty common that they misrepresent what's actually in the legislation?
Yes. I think that that's true, but not to the extent that I mean, I've never seen it where, you know, you could have different interpretations of something, right? Or you could say, well, that's not, but to cite things as RFRA cases when they weren't RFRA cases, that's just a blatant, not true. Right. So I think that's the difference that blew me away yesterday. And the fact that they're talking about the law being divisive when, in fact, they're creating the divisiveness by characterizing it in ways that are fundamentally not true.
Wow. Well, good thing we have representatives like you on the floor to call them out on it.
Well, it was amazing. I was very, very proud of the Republican caucus this week that came together. And I would encourage people, if they have time, to go look at the debate on the Iowa History Initiative. You can go to the Iowa Legislative website, find it on Wednesday. Numerous Republicans. I mean, normally, a lot of times when we're running legislation, we don't stand up and do rebuttals to all the things they're saying, because in the end, we're going to win. We're going to pass the legislation. So a lot of times we just allow the floor manager to respond in their closing remarks. But with the American History Initiative, numerous Republican legislators stood up and talk about the importance of our history and the importance of doing what we were doing. And I think it was a very profound moment that I think, frankly, took the other side by surprise, because they're used to just sort of ranting and going unchecked until the closing remarks didn't happen with the Iowa History Initiative. And it was just a wonderful debate to watch.
I'll see if we can find that and put a link in the description as well.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. How about the AEA bill?
Yeah. Well, briefly, the bill that the Iowa House passed, the AEA bill, I just feel like they're still talking about the original bill, and there's just so much disinformation out there. The bill that we passed is not like the original bill. It doesn't touch special education services. They will continue exactly as they are now. The AEAs will continue to be mandated to provide those services. It does begin to give the school district some flexibility on some other funding related to services that the AEA provides, and media and some things of that kind. But it's stretched out over a much longer time frame. The things we heard concerned about were the timeline was not workable. The timeline's gone. The fact that the AEA services would become optional and the school district could use different AEAs or different organizations for their special education services, or even could bring them in-house. And while I continue to believe that that's a worthy goal, we didn't do any of those things in the bill we passed. The special ed services continue to be mandated to be provided by the AEAs. But we did with some of the media services money, things like that, in year two and on, we began to give some flexibility to the school districts to decide whether they want to use the AEA, continue to use the AEA, or whether they want to bring it in-house or use some other service. We created a task force. That's what we kept being asked to do, create a task force to study this issue. And so we created a task force. We put all the important folks on it. The AEAs are represented. School superintendents are represented. Parents are represented. We have legislators on it, of course, to try to look at how we can improve the system. So the criticism really that I'm hearing now, and we did move some oversight over to the Department of Education, because that's important. The Department of Education is responsible for our special education scores, and there used to be a special education division within the Department of Education. That was gotten rid of some years ago. That was probably a mistake. We're reestablishing that. But the folks within the Department of Education, there'll be some folks within the DOE in Des Moines that will be overseeing this, but also a lot of those folks are going to be embedded in the AEAs. So it's not, you know, transferring all the power to Des Moines. So it's completely different than what was advocated for originally. And I think that what we're actually going to do with that task force is actually determine what ways can we do this better? What ways can we improve our special education scores? We don't need to be protecting kingdoms. And that's to some extent, I think some of the criticism is, you know, we can't touch the AEAs. We can't touch them. Well, yes, we can, because we need to make sure that if the objective is the best education possible for our children, then we always need to be looking for ways to innovate and do better. And the AEAs were created in the 1970s. Certainly, we can look at how we can do it better. But right. None of the things that people feared about the original legislation are in the bill that we passed. And
and if people that are watching go back to our first episode, you were not for that version
right.
of the AEA. And it seems like you've really taken the feedback, and it's a completely different bill.
Right. And if the task force comes back, we certainly, even the AEAs have told us they believe the AEAs could be consolidated, because the amount of money being paid to the AEA chiefs and the number of AEAs we have, and the amount of money that is being paid to the management sector or portion of AEAs, it doesn't really, you know, get into the classroom with our special education students. Clearly, we can do better right. on that. There is very no doubt about that. Yeah, and even they acknowledge that. So those are going to be some of the things I'm probably that the task force will make recommendations to us on. But again, the special education services are not touched in the bill that we passed. And then we will see what the recommendations are from the task force, which is made up of AEA folks and school superintendents, where the rubber meets the road. And we'll see what their recommendations are.
And there was a task force made last year for DEI in the Regent schools, and I know that that's being worked on this session. Where's that at?
We just passed the higher education bill that gets rid of the DEI stuff. It's over. It's based on the recommendations from the Regents themselves, and it gets rid of the DEI programs. The massive amount of money that's being spent on these DEI folks, one of the schools is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for DEI chiefs. And it would be different if the diversity, equity, inclusion really was what those words sound like. But instead, they're teaching that meritocracy, which is getting ahead based on your work ethic, that is a part of white supremacy. They're teaching that if you're white, you're inherently a racist. And if you're a minority, you're oppressed. I mean, it is ridiculous what these things are teaching. And so there's this huge chasm between what DEI should be and what it sounds like it is and what it actually is. And so when the Democrats are up on the floor arguing on how these DEI programs must be preserved, I think what they're talking about would be something I would probably be interested in preserving. But the problem is that's not what these programs have done. They have created so much, taking us backwards. You know, Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, his dream about judging on character instead of skin color, just the opposite of what these DEI programs are doing. And that's why we say, okay, they need to be gone. And so that's only one of the things in the bill. There's a lot of other things in the Regents bill that addresses some of the things that we have seen going on there. And we'll see that was passed also and is headed over to the Senate.
Fantastic. What is the outlook there? Or do you have any idea?
Well, I certainly think there's going to be some pushback. We really push we're pushing the envelope in the House on a lot of things, and we push the envelope in the Regents bill. So I certainly think that the Senate will have some concerns and we'll have to work through those. I certainly hope that what will be retained in the bill and ultimately sent to the governor's desk is the end of those DEI programs based upon the recommendations from the group that met within the Regents and made that recommendation to us. So I think that will be, I hope that will survive. Some of the other things we'll just have to see.
Yeah, for sure. You guys are doing great work up there. Is there anything else that you can think of? What's next week?
Yeah, the one thing, well, we mentioned it briefly, but the one thing I would mention is we also passed a bill we couldn't have even touched a few years ago to examine Common Core and start beginning to look at how we can replace Common Core with something that actually works better. And we passed that bill, kind of amazing. It wasn't even a lot of debate on that one. So that was very interesting. So that we've sent that over to the Senate. We'll see where that goes. Again, a lot of the bills we did this year were focused on education, or excuse me, this week were focused on education.
For people, people that may not understand, what has been the big challenge with Common Core with some of them?
Oh gosh, where do I start? Well, I think there's a lot of things in the science Common Core standards that are tied into climate change and into the liberal agenda of getting rid of fossil fuels that we think need to go. The way math is being taught today, and they've succeeded in getting their agenda, the sort of leftist agenda, is permeated a lot of Common Core. But set that aside, I think some of the standards in Common Core, I think our history standards in Common Core are one of the reasons that our history is lousy today in our public schools. They're so vague. In fact, there was a group, I can't think of the group right now, but it's a nationally recognized organization that goes and they study the social studies curriculum standards in various states and the civic standards. We got a D and an F in Iowa on our social studies and civic standards, but from that organization, we got a D and an F. So it's not just, you know, it's not Republicans that are saying, you know, these things need to be revised. It's a national organization that goes and looks at these things throughout the states. And they said, yeah, you're a D and an F because they're so vague. And the things they talk about with these standards are so vague, they really give no guidance to teachers on what they need to do. And they seem to be vague to me so that you can talk about white supremacy and you can talk about the ills of Western civilization and you don't necessarily have to talk about any of the good things. And so I think that there's just a lot of problems with Common Core. And it seems to me that ever since we've adopted that sort of Bill Gates funded Common Core standards, we've gone downhill. And so we just want to look at those standards and see what we can do better. We did, you know, when we didn't have the Common Core standards, Iowa was leading the nation, I think, in education. And so we just think it's time to take a look at that and let the experts take a look at it and see what we can do to do better. So,
yeah, that's great. That is fantastic. All right. Well, we look forward to seeing more happen next week. Is there anything on the agenda that jumps out at you or?
There always is. I'm running a bill to try to get rid of guaranteed income programs. I think we may have talked about that.
Yeah, we did.
On your broadcast in the past. We've had some pushback on that from some folks that are concerned about local control. And my response to that is local control is extremely important, but state and city and county governments only exist because the state created them and the state gives them the power to do what they do. And when you're talking about a fundamental issue such as socialism versus capitalism, such as continuing down the road to socialism, that issue has to trump local control. And so I'm continuing to work to get that to the floor. We also have a number of immigration bills that are going to push the envelope. If we pass them, I'm certain we'll be sued by the federal government, just like Texas was. But we've had enough. And so those bills may well be coming to the floor next week or in the weeks to come.
Do you know anything about Senate File 108? It's about the E-Verify and holding employers accountable for, you know, the potential of having somebody work for them that may not be verified.
Yeah. A number of my colleagues in the House are not fans of E-Verify. They believe garbage in, garbage out. They don't believe it's an effective program, particularly with what's been going on with it on the federal government, who may be controlling it on the federal government. So they see it as a burden to business that really doesn't advance us down the road. So that's not one that we're looking at other things we can do, but that's one that we may or may not pass because there's a lot of concerns on our side related to its ineffectiveness and the additional burden it might place on businesses. So the discussion's continuing on E-Verify. Some of the bills we're moving would you know, disincentivize coming to Iowa, not getting money, public assistance money, if you can't prove that you're in the state legally. You don't have to be a citizen, but you have to be here legally, and then creating a crime for smuggling, human smuggling, so that we can ICE refuses to do anything with these people when DPS gets a hold of them, then DPS needs some sort of a means to be able to hold them based on state law. And so those are, and I think we're going to be challenged on some of these things by a Biden administration who wants an invasion on our border. I'm sorry, but he does. He has plenty of authority to end what's happening on the border. He's choosing not to do it. And because that's what they want. And so it's time for states to stand up for our sovereignty and fight back. And if that means going to court and being sued, then so be it. That's what we're going to have to do until we begin to win these cases. Right now, the state law in Texas that allowed Texas to arrest people that are in the state illegally has been put on hold by a federal judge. This is what we're fighting. A court system who continues to believe that federal immigration, that the federal government controls immigration laws and the states can't do anything about it. I disagree with them. I think there's plenty of places in the Constitution that show that states have a right to protect their sovereignty. So this battle is going to continue in the courts, and we have to push the envelope. We've got no choice.
Yeah, that's for sure. And we've got an epidemic going on.
Absolutely do.
Okay, well, I think that we've covered a lot today, and I appreciate you joining us again.
Sure, it's great to be here.
Yeah. What do we have left? This is March 1st, so last day of session.
Oh, gosh, it's 100 days from the day we started, so it's sometime in April. I couldn't even give you the exact date. It's something in the third week of April,
right.
Whether we get done on time or not this year. I certainly hope we do. But, you know, the AEA proposals are something we're going to have to work through because we're going to be in a very different place than the Senate is. We may be in a very different place than the governor is. And so we're going to have to work through those issues and see what happens. So, if we get done on time, it'll be sometime in the late part of April.
All right. Well, we'll continue to talk until then and try to keep everybody in the loop about what's going on. So thanks.
Sounds great,
sir. Joining us. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have a blessed weekend.
Thank you. You too, sir.